This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
I'm a Sherman Paladino.
You've missed us on your commute.
Oh, yes.
You're driving and you're driving with any sound, driving in silence to
This is my favorite impression that Alice does. I've heard thousands that she does is when she impersonates a podcast listener by going,
"My commute."
You really help my community.
No, come on. That's sweet when people say that.
Well, I identify with it. I'm the same person.
I identify with it, and I always receive it well because I'm on the other end of that equation with a lot of my favorite shows.
That's what I just said, Kevin.
Right, but I was just saying it differently.
We're starting off great because I'm already mad at you.
I love you so much. I'm so excited
to tolerate you with affection.
Hang out with you. I know, and that's all I deserve. Welcome to season two of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel-Goyes. I'm Kevin.
And I'm Alice.
And we are
The Maisel-Goyes.
We are The Maisel-Goyes. It's been a little bit since we've recorded together. I don't even remember.
What
passed me by?
At the end of last season, I just completely couldn't record anymore. Did I go to Toronto?
That was a little wild. I remember for the very last episode that you just said, "I can't."
I don't remember.
You
but
were
there
still
was something
in town.
Really stressful.
There was something bad. Yeah.
There
so it's just
upsetting.
me and Jason and
I
him roasting me for
sick.
An hour. Hey, listen. I'm grateful for every minute of time I get with you because I treasure
you.
It and value it very much.
Thank you so much, Kevin.
And
thank
doing
you so
the,
much.
Thank you. Thank you in
Thanks
return.
Thank you so much. Our friendship means a lot to me, Kevin.
This is why I want to keep doing the show. Like, I'm as excited as I am for season two of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel on Amazon Prime. I'm more excited or as excited
as
to record with you.
Me too.
And get to hang out with
you. Well, this is the funnest hang.
Do you feel like
yeah,
it?
Yeah, that we do.
Oh, come on. No. I thought you were saying in your life.
I love talking with you.
I know you do. Well, let's talk about how things have changed since the last time we recorded.
Yes.
Because we're recording these in December of 2018. The last time we recorded was probably February of this same year. These may not come out till January, maybe February. We'll see.
Yeah.
But we're going to bank them and then put them out.
Yeah.
As opposed to, like, you know, putting the cart before the horse. But let's talk about some of the ways in which the Marvelous Mrs. Maisel and Miss Amy Sherman Paladino have changed in the context and the landscape of TV.
Let's talk about it.
It is a different ballgame now. It was a different ballgame from the time they premiered and they got critical acclaim and such. But let me play you words I never thought I would ever live to hear.
Here we go. The Emmy for writing for a comedy series goes to Amy Sherman Paladino.
Wow. And they go, I'd like to point out, they go wild.
They go nutty pajetti. She's hugging Daniel. She's doing a Babadook-like strut down the red carpet. There's Shalhoub. She's hugging Shalhoub. She's giving Rachel Brosnahan a kiss on the little cheek. She's going up to stage doing a Bill Hader's bomb that he didn't win. They cut to him.
Oh, man, that makes me so happy that she beat Bill Hader.
Uh-oh. And she says...
Thank you.
You're so gorgeous.
Hi. Whoever put that carpet down hates women. I just want to say that right away. Time's up, okay?
She makes a time's up joke.
Alex Borstein made me rip my tights. Whatever, I'll get through this. I just want to say my father inspired this, weirdly. So I had to turn a 6'2" Bronx Jew into Rachel Brosnahan. That's Hollywood. So I want to thank him. And I want to thank my husband, Daniel Paladino. You are the Sid to my Nancy, mister. And my cast. Your graciousness, your hard work, your brilliance, and
That'd
your
be
endurance,
you.
And the fact that you graciously accept that sometimes it matters when you drop the I thank you, I love you, goodbye.
Wow. Amy Sherman Paladino won an Emmy for writing. Amy Sherman-Palladino won an Emmy for directing. The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel won 8 Emmy Awards, fuck, including Best Comedy.
Fuck.
This is a game changer. Okay, so
right,
for people who followed this and watched Gilmore, went to Bunheads on ABC Family, where she had 2 paper clips and a match as a budget. And now we're just...
And somehow shot, her budget was 2 paper clips and a matchbook, and she ended up shooting with only 1 paper clip. I don't know what happened to the fucking budget. It
that was a very strange episode of Bunheads. But now we're here. She's always been a character I've been fascinated with as much as her on-screen characters. I'm as fascinated with Lorelai Gilmore as I am with Amy Sherman-Palladino.
Right.
And now it's changed. I mean, she's someone who's like fun to watch as an auteur in the way that like a David Simon or an Aaron Sorkin was. But now she's been acting all of her life as she was like King Shit of Fuck Mountain. Mm-hmm. Now she kind of is. It's different. Now she has finally had the amount of widespread success, not niche success, that affords you the ability to go over budget, to be mean, to be an auteur with ideas, to be someone that people don't say no to. Mm-hmm. She's finally arrived, and now she is the cool kid that people want to sit with in the cafeteria. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she's Joss Whedon.
Hopefully not in all ways.
Yeah, whereas Joss Whedon came out strong with Buffy in like very early on in his career, and then that gained popularity after the fact. It's like, I wonder if Gilmore is going to get the appreciation after the fact, you know, that what if it was Bunheads? I wonder if Bunheads is going to get
Bunheads is going to be the
Buffy
like,
following.
Brilliant, but canceled. Yeah. I think that Gilmore has gotten all the critical acclaim and praise and adulation it'll ever receive.
I think that's in part to you and Demi. To be honest with
you. Is that true?
Yeah, I really do.
You know what's funny, though, is I think that the Netflix revival will depreciate it. Mm-hmm. And the way that now we think of Arrested Development is like, oh, it's that thing that kind of went on for 10 years or whatever, or like 15 years and had 3 whatever seasons. Like, unfortunately, the revival did ding it a little bit. But Amy is now, she has a holding deal with Amazon. Maisel's renewed for season 3. She has all the... She's whereas before, she couldn't get a pilot off the ground. The Wyoming Project starring What's-Her-Name couldn't get made. So it's different now.
It makes me really, I don't know, it makes me hopeful for, I guess, the future of this kind of storytelling because, well, when I say this kind of storytelling, I just mean like women's storytelling. It makes me hopeful for the future of like being an auteur type woman in Hollywood because I don't see myself and my trajectory that way because I'm not like a writer like she is. Mm-hmm. I don't have that. But I have a voice and I do write my own stuff. And I have been in the position so many times of like, I wonder if since I haven't made the leap into success that a lot of my peers have, not a lot, but some of my peers who are deserved have, but I haven't gotten there and I've had shows almost get made several times and then not get made. And it's like, it just hasn't come together for
me. Which is most people's reality.
Which is most people's reality. And it's fine. And I'm very happy with my life. But at the same time, to watch ASP go through this, it's like, oh, there's a world in which my time might come later in my life. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, there's a world in which I might not just age out of relevance anymore. It doesn't feel like we're living in a world anymore where as you age as an actress, you get – or a stand-up or any of that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It just makes me feel more hopeful.
I think this is –
because she's, like, not only an elder woman, she's not statesmanly. She's not like that lady who directed Hurt Locker.
Oh, Bigelow?
She's not
Bigelow?
Like any of those other female directors. She's not a Jane Campion. And she's not, you know, she's like this fucking crazy weirdo.
Yeah. You see hers as a trajectory and a story of like not compromising over time.
Exactly.
Sometimes does work out.
Exactly.
She did not play the game. She did not say, okay, Jamie Tarsus,
she's
I'll do
never
that.
Been somebody that anybody wanted to like sleep with.
She's never been someone who's like, oh, yeah, she's an easy hang.
Yeah. You know what I mean? She can't hang with the boys and have a beer unless they're literal newsboys, you know? Like
the Christian rock band newsboys.
The Christian rock.
I will say, as far as the Emmy stuff goes,
sorry, this isn't your other podcast.
Sorry, what other podcast? Treks in the City on Campfire Media.
What?
Or Forever Dog. Which one is it? I always get the two mixed up.
What is Campfire Media?
So it's Forever Dog.
Yeah.
Okay. So. Another thing that you have to, just from a technical perspective, as much as I celebrate it and the 8 wins, This will not happen next year because there was a vacuum created in that Veep did not get nominated for anything because Veep didn't have a season.
Right.
Because Julia Louis-Dreyfus took the year off to fight cancer.
Right.
So it kind of created the vet where Brosnahan won. Alex Borstein won.
Yeah.
Alex Borstein had the best walk-up. Can I show it to you real quick?
Yeah, please show it to me.
Everyone who's listening, please Google Alex Borstein's acceptance.
The Emmy for Supporting Actress in a Comedy Series goes to...
Alex Borstein.
She goes, fuck. She mouths the word fuck.
I love you,
sit next
woman.
To Will Sasso, Matt TV alum. And what does she do? Check it out.
Oh my God!
She unwraps her silver gown to unveil another silver gown with no bra, which she comments on in her acceptance speech.
My God,
Actually, her speech is very sweet.
I went without the bra. What a platform. Ladies, when you use a public restroom, sit down. If you sit, we can all sit. Stop peeing on the seat. I want to thank everyone at Amazon. I want to thank Amy Sherman-Palladino. You are my friend. I love you and I hate you. I want to thank the writers, the entire
cast. I think
cast.
That's what
You're
being
amazing.
Friends with her
the crew,
like.
The crew, the crew. You do everything. We see you. My family, Anyukam, Nadjan Seretlek, you are our everything. My father, you are the only man who has ever truly loved or taken care of me. Thank you for that. My brothers, my Lala, life is possible with you. Mi Morena, and my children, you are everything.
Oh, I cut it off there. Whoops.
I'm crying. And every acceptance speech makes me cry. Let's find one that doesn't.
And again, this is like, these are Rocky stories at this point. I think for people that probably listen to this podcast and like Gilmore from the beginning, where it's like, she couldn't do Suki because of Mad TV and McCarthy's got this huge career now, which is due to many things, including Gilmore. But it's like that usually... Mm-hmm. Everyone loves a comeback story. Yeah. This is a strange... Yeah. And I know it's like, all these people work and they have money and she's been Lois for 20 years, but still, it's nice to see validation on this level.
It's just nice. Mm-hmm. And it isn't like... To see them get it is just nice. And to know they would be fine without it because they're Alex Borstein is somebody, is like a performer with integrity who I appreciate.
Totally.
And Amy Sherman-Palladino... Her personal foibles aside, is like somebody who, didn't compromise. And so to see them get these things just in terms of just creatively to get these accolades is nice. They would be fine without them. However, it will change. She is, you know, the king shit of Fuck Mountain.
Now I wonder how it will change. It is wild to think, oh, Miss Swan won an Emmy. Miss Swan won an Emmy.
Who's what? I don't know.
Well, X-Borstein played Miss Swan, which is a... Sort of, definitely racist character from Mad TV where she did an Asian accent. And
all right.
Anyway, on a long enough time frame, all things are redeemed.
Right.
So let's talk about...
That's so...
Including actresses.
So doesn't...
What?
So not true. All things.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm trying to be optimistic.
It's great. Anyway...
No, I just, I have hope that one day all things will work together for someone's good. Maybe mine. Maybe Amy Sherman-Palladino. I will say,
I just want power.
I'm very scared of her now, more so than ever. Because imagine how scared I was of her before. Mm-hmm. Now she has all this acclaim. Mm-hmm. All the cool kids in school said, she's cool too. She's one of us.
Yeah. However, she goes about her life believing it anyway. So how is that really going to change? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And maybe it's actually going to be better because she's not just going to be this psycho, like, you know what I mean?
Reality will adjust to her.
Reality will adjust to her reality, which is actually going to help people around her because it's no longer somebody who's like, I'm the best. Why is everybody saying no? It's somebody going, I'm the best. And everybody's like, yes, you are. And she's like, okay, that conversation's over. Now let's make these creative decisions. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So there is something nice. Yeah. Everyone's played catch up and we're all on the same page. The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel will go on for at least 5 seasons,
probably.
Right?
Yeah.
Like everything's a 4 or 5 season show now.
Means we will too.
And we will. Hey, I look forward to an opportunity to hang out with you.
As you've said.
During the hiatus, we only hung out a handful of times. It made me sad. And it was mostly my fault. I make myself unavailable.
You make yourself insanely unavailable. And you are not grateful for the times we do hang out.
I am
you're like,
super.
You talk about. You're like, it's so Al-Anon to be like, when we do hang out, you're like, we only hung out a couple times and it made me sad.
No, I said I was very grateful for it.
But why didn't it make you happy that we did hang out?
It did make me very happy.
Some people I don't hang out with at all.
I know. And again, that's why I'm so grateful. I like to grovel to my co-host before starting in a discussion.
I like to shut that shit down.
I know. And that's why we work. Let's talk about episode 201 of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. No guest for this episode because we want to reset,
really
refresh, and really...
And do go work out our issues.
And really work it out. This is 201. The episode is Simone. The Amazon Prime synopsis is, in the season 2 premiere, Midge takes the stage for a foreign audience while Abe and Rose find themselves in a new world. Susie experiences the repercussions of having a bad reputation in the business as Joel regroups after quitting his job. And of course, it's time for the segment we always do on this show, which is called
12 o'clock rock and
pop
around
culture
tonight.
I missed it.
Pop around the culture tonight.
Pop around the culture.
Where we take every pop culture reference in the episode and put them in a supercut. I feel like I'm in a time warp right now.
Yeah, I understand.
Oh my God.
Just stick with it.
It's 2018, right?
It is.
Who's the president?
Yeah.
Oh no. This is 201 Pop Around the Culture.
Amelia Earhart.
Will Elizabeth Taylor become Bar Mitzvah?
A star was born.
Put down Jerry Lewis.
Tony beat the shit out of Martha Ray last week.
You're Norman Mailer in a cocktail dress.
I think we were giving away Pat Boone tickets.
Proust.
Leave him out of it.
And I might have called him Salminia, which I would like to point out that many people would take as a compliment.
Here's the card of a psychiatrist who just moved to New York from Boston. He's done wonders for my friend Sylvia Plath.
I laughed out loud at that line in my home.
You know what I did?
I scream laughed. It was really funny.
You want to hear my reaction
yes.
to that line?
Really?
I think that's the sort of line that I was so afraid all of the show would be under a Daniel Palladino co-EP'd show.
The joke is the historical reference and what happens.
It's the reference itself. It's the Carole King Beautiful Syndrome.
The joke is the context, yeah.
That song will never work. What's it called? The Locomotion. Bah! Like, and everyone just loses their minds. Like, Sylvia Plath was that stuff.
I don't know. My argument for this joke and why it made me laugh so hard was that it is that same, it's totally that format, which is frustrating, but I don't know. It just really nailed for me how sad everybody was for her at the end. It went from being this like uproarious good time where it's like, wow, okay, she can do stand-up in another language. Oh, that's so crazy. And she's like getting in touch with the French culture and she's really like able to do this thing, which is so amazing. And then like at the very end, her story is, you know, goes in this direction. Everybody just is like, hey, you know, you should probably talk to this person that's talking to Sylvia Plath. And I almost took it at first. The reason I laughed at it at first, I was like, in this, maybe Sylvia Plath is already suicidal. And like, mm-hmm. she's like, that's how bad you are right now. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's not that like Sylvia Plath ends up killing herself. It's that like, she knows it's a current reference to the fact that Sylvia Plath is a notoriously suicidal weirdo.
I see. Yeah. You could totally read it from that. Because I felt like season one was pretty resistant
you
and pretty
did, yeah.
disciplined with that
so
sort of thing.
Like, episode one.
It's an up and comer. His name's Woody Allen. Like, there's nothing like that. And this one, I was like, uh-oh. Yeah, I did like...
Was there a lot of those? It flew over my head in this episode.
In this episode, no. I think that was the only one, really.
Because,
again, that's what's so lovely about this format and this genre and period stuff is like that sort of thing. If you can do it conversantly of like, who is it? Betsy Ray or whoever mm-hmm. the actress was. Forgive me. I made the cut, but I forget who it was. It's like, I know who that is. I don't need to know who it is. You get it by context. You can look it up later. Like, they are still good at that. They're not underlining and bolding and italicizing.
They're also not making a satire.
Right.
You know, this is a story and this is the way they're telling it.
Yeah. So let's talk about overall the episode in general. We read the synopsis, but it is an episode in which they go to Paris to get Midge's mom, Rose, mm-hmm. and things fall apart, and the mafia, as sicked on by David Paymer from season one, Sophie's old agent, goes to rough them up. Because that's who sent the goons after Susie.
Because I was going to ask you about that. I was confused about...
They didn't draw the line that clearly between those two. But yeah, that's who it was.
Because at the end of it, I was like, okay, does Susie have a secret?
Like, no, it's truly... Mm-hmm. He said after she docked Sophie Lennon, he was like, oh, you'll never work in this town. You're blah, 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 blah. So I thought it's like, he's going to shut you out of all the clubs. Now, I'm going to send people to kill you.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is pretty wild. This episode, going to Paris... shooting on location in Paris.
I know.
I'm going to date us now. I'm going to date this time that we're recording this podcast and the climate that we're in. But this episode is the Amy Sherman Palladino definition of weird flex, but okay.
Yeah, it is.
It's, period stuff is so expensive.
Yeah.
Shooting overseas for a thing that shoots in New York within Union friggin', you know, radius is to do period in Paris for like three scenes, like two exteriors and like to gorgeous effect, which we can talk about. But that is
the Thames, like the scene by the river.
Yes.
You can't the final really shot. Get the Thames unless you're doing that.
No, and I think it wasn't until the final shot where I'm like, oh, okay, this was worth it.
For
just that final tableau of her walking away from the phone.
For me, for sure.
Yeah, but...
That hit me so hard.
Yeah. Oh,
I ugly cried.
Really?
Anyway, we'll get to it.
We should have watched it together. Maybe we'll watch the next one together.
He just wants to see me cry.
No, I just want to spend time with you.
He just wants me to be sad.
I've never seen you cry. I think it's time for us to take it to that next level.
He just wants me to be sad, so I need him.
I've only heard you crying over the phone.
Oh, okay. Here we go. Now we're really getting into our deep, deep issues.
Yeah, but going to Paris is just like, can you imagine, like, the lady who, when she wanted to go to Paris before, it's like, let's put a baguette in the window at WB and call it a day. And now it's like, yeah, we're going to spend...
In the window.
As far as, like, Amazon spends, guys, everyone who has a Prime account, you paid for this scene. All you millions of people who have Prime accounts.
And so did the employees who just got bear repellent all over them.
Oh, it's very sad. But it is like, I mean, did you ever watch the Romanoffs, the Matt Weiner thing that Amazon's
doing?
No, I
haven't seen that.
I haven't seen it. I haven't wanted to see it.
I don't care to watch those vignette-y, these stories.
The anthology stuff.
If I don't fucking care. If I don't follow it, why binge something where you don't...
Right, it just seems like little movies or something. But
yeah.
But with that, it just
seems
like...
not even Louis C.K. in everyone.
Oh, boy. Yeah, someone gave a kind of scorching review where it's like, this series is kind of reminiscent of late period Woody Allen. Like, you know, Curse of the Jade Scorpion or Match Pointy stuff. It's like, no, okay, we're good. But yeah, that show too was defined by, oh boy, you really did not need to shoot on location.
Right.
You didn't need to spend $100 million on every episode or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. But you did. And it does work to some effect in this episode. But I will say, there's a great podcast called The Watch from the Ringer Network, Andy Greenwald, Chris Ryan, and they were talking about this episode today. And they made a really astute observation that this almost feels like a season 4 or 5 move, where it's like, hey, kids, we're going to Paris. Like, you know, like the Brady Bunch would do, to Hawaii or something like that.
And that's why Weird Flex, But Okay.
Right. Because it's like, we're doing this already?
Here's the thing about it, though. And this is why... I was into it. Mm-hmm. You know, it reminds me of when after I saw Ghostbusters for the first time.
84?
No, the new Ghostbusters 2000... with all the women in it. I hated
it. Ruined my childhood. You hated it?
The new, that's, you're trying to be seem young and you're like, the new Ghostbusters ruined my childhood.
The animators.
So I saw it and I was in Toronto shooting People of Earth, and I went with Oscar Nunez and Tracy Chimo, and Tracy and I were just like losing our minds. We hated it so much. We were just like, bah, 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 bah. And Oscar was like, you know what though? Women should get to make shitty movies too. And I was like, that's true. It's an interesting perspective. So like that sentiment comes to mind when I think like, okay, big budget, like the Romanoffs isn't, like Matt Weiner shouldn't be the, you know, the guys shouldn't be the only people to be able to make these big stupid money moves all the time.
Yeah,
and it does feel like we live in that world. And so for Amy to be able to do this, and I feel like it paid off and it worked, I feel like she's like, we could go to Paris and it could, and then at the end, it didn't feel hollow to me at all, like the way that it played to the end of the episode and the walk off and the scene by the Thames for sure.
I think you're tapping into something interesting though, in that it is so permissive when we talk about, I love talking about this stuff in the big picture of like what happens culturally and in this industry, where there's an expectation of like, they went 20 million over, but he's a genius.
Exactly.
But then there's the bad side of that coin is like, well, Patty Jenkins, she made it. She actually came in under budget, and she was like a really, responsible steward with Wonder Woman, and, mm-hmm. and Kathryn Bigelow did Hurt Locker for X amount of money, and yeah. she was really, and you see that there's been some really great retrospective pieces on the Twilight franchise, and talking about Catherine Hardwicke and how she made this movie and she did this, and she was, I think there was a little Paladino vibes mm-hmm. on that movie. She was eccentric, she mm-hmm. made strange choices, mm-hmm. but the movie did well. But yeah, you're right in that mm-hmm. there is a strange expectation. I don't think we as an audience and as viewers of culture are that used to
right.
female excess.
Well, that's
do you know what I mean?
I feel like Ava DuVernay might be a good, like she might be the next iteration of that. You know what I mean?
And did you see Wrinkle in Time?
I did see Wrinkle in Time. And that was, it was a gorgeous shit show.
Yeah.
Right? And but there was so many good things about it in terms of like, man, there was some really good performances. But like, even Mindy Kaling was so good in a way I didn't think she was going to be at all. I was like, oh my god, she's not at all for this. And then I was like really into it. Anyway, whatever. I was kind of standing for that performance. But
my favorite was the branded content at the end for Lin-Manuel Miranda to star in Mary Poppins, because the last quote she says was incredibly weird. It was so strange,
yeah.
right? Because she's quoting all these authors and philosophers, yeah. and then at the end she's like, let's have another round tonight. Miranda 2015 or whatever
right,
the hell.
Right.
It wasn't
so
that.
Bizarre.
It was something like that, yeah.
There was so much bizarre shit going
yes.
on. But Ava DuVernay also is somebody who has been given a great amount of trust, you know, because there's this potential with her that is, I think, undeniable. And, like, that makes me so happy. And I think Shonda Rhimes is another character who I feel like has that female excess thing going on, where it's, like, Shonda Rhimes not necessarily – definitely with budget, but also just with, like, decision-making and, like, oh, I don't like the way you're talking to me. You're off my fucking show, and you're dying. You
oh,
know,
yeah.
like,
she,
your
Shonda,
character's going to die now.
She's good at killing people for just, being bad people.
It's fucking awesome. You know, and, like, it's –
but she's very like she's responsible for like 0.2% of all of Walt Disney Corporation's profits for the
yeah.
last couple of years. So you're talking about like creative excesses, but like commercial. I guess these we're talking about the same thing
mm-hmm.
in a way.
In a way, yeah. Just, well, it's definitely connected.
Yeah, we just need to get more used to female auteurs, and Paladino.
Yeah, that's
is
why I'm saying
helping
like,
us get used to it.
Yeah, and I also feel like. Beyond that, even that, the Paris thing for me totally worked. I mean, when they got there, I was like, are they really fucking going to Paris? And then they're on the street and it's like where they shot Amelie. And you're like, are you kidding me? But then when we got to the night shots and you know, it was like, okay, yeah, we're in Paris.
Oh, you
we
could
need
totally
to be in Paris.
Oh, you were skeptical at first that they were like dressing it as something else?
No, I was just like, I can't believe they fucking went to Paris.
Oh, gotcha.
Like it's a season 5 thing. But the fact that it's in season 2 in the episode 1 of season 2, it's not even a weird flex to me. It's like a yes flex. It's like, this is where we're, this is, you know, this is what this story is about. This,
yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
This story goes to these places and it, as it goes to Paris, it goes into this incredible emotional depth at the same time. I felt like for Rachel's story, not Rachel, but Midge's story. And then it goes to the docks in Brooklyn for this really kooky, weird story. Like it was.
Well, we can talk about that. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Squarespace. Now, unlike anything I've ever talked about on the air, I actually stand by Squarespace. I actually do because I've used it for everything I've made. Literally, GilmoreGuysShow.com, the very website for this very podcast, was made using Squarespace. How beautiful is that? KevinTPorter.com, I made that using Squarespace. My old bake shop website, that was made using Squarespace. Because you can do it all with Squarespace. You can sell content on your website. So exclusive stuff behind a paywall. You can sell memberships, courses, or sell files your customers can download, like PDFs, music, or eBooks. You can do that with Squarespace. You can do analytics with Squarespace. So you can figure out who's visiting your website and why. And figure out how to get traffic and where's it coming from. You can also have people do flexible payments on Squarespace. Make checkout seamless for your customers with simple but powerful payment tools. Accepts credit cards, PayPal, Apple Pay, and in eligible countries, offer customers the option to buy now and pay later with Afterpay and ClearPay. How nice is that? You can also do email campaigns, so there's constant outreach for your stuff and people know where to find you. So I'm going to let you know where to find Squarespace. Head to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/GilmoreGuys to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain.
That's squarespace.com/Gilmore, guys. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Now let's talk about your social battery. Maybe right now it's bursting at the seams with energy. Maybe it's a little drained. Maybe you're one of those people like my friend with their phone battery that keeps it 2% all the time, even when they stay home all day. And they definitely could charge up if they wanted to, but they don't. Well, regardless of where it is, it's important to understand why it is the way it is. Why is the battery low when it gets low? Is it because you're feeling less social? Is it because you're feeling sad? Is it because of emotions you've yet to identify? Or maybe just boundaries you haven't set for yourself yet? Either way, it can be easy to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves too thin, especially with social gatherings picking up after the winter. What's the right amount of socializing for you? How do you recharge? Maybe you thrive around people, maybe you don't. Maybe you need a little more alone time. Well, either way, therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. This is so important because I've been in therapy for 10 plus years, for some would say, technically, 11 years this month, and it's helped me so much understand where I get my energy from, how I use my energy, how to better use my energy, and how to maintain things in a way that's sustainable and healthy and good. And that's to do, of course, with boundaries, but also just understanding who I am and what I want. And I couldn't have done so much of that work without therapy. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/Gilmore Guys today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Gilmore Guys.
Can I back it up to the teaser, though?
Can I back it up?
Can I back it up?
Yeah.
To the teaser score to Just Leave Everything to Me, yep. Barbara Streisand and Hello Dolly, whipping through the department store that Midge is working at. She's at the switchboard now, and everyone's relying on her to take all the calls and blah, 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 blah. The way they shot this scene was like Fincher in Fight Club or Panic Room. We're going through mail slots. We're zipping by. We're doing this and that. It was like, I've never thought of Palette, I think I've made this point before in other episodes of Maisel, but I've never thought of her as like a visual auteur. It's always been like dialogue stuff. But now with like the world at her disposal, I think, is this how she always wanted to shoot stuff but just couldn't? Mm. Like, did she want to like zoom through Luke's diner's keyhole and go through into the coffee and like, it's zippy and it
fits
the world.
That is, because it was always... Everything she shot always looked like a fucking stage play before.
Yeah.
A lot of this stuff is really also dependent on the fact that you have the money to work with this DP when you're working with, you know, the budget you have at WB. Now you're on Amazon, they want a different look. They will want that. And so if she – this is what I think it looks like when she gets to choose her DP. But I think – I want to see who she's working with in terms of art director and director of photography.
Yeah.
I would imagine that some of the choices were – like something that she's been inspired by later in her career, you know?
I think that's probably
like,
right.
I don't think she's always wanted to do this. I think that...
And now she's unbridled or something.
Yeah,
Here's what unbridled. I think is for sure, though. She ain't never coming back to the West Coast. She ain't never coming back. She's never going to shoot anything here again.
Mm.
I think she's too in love with the state she's in. And she's like, well, I think I can just make a show for Amazon now and shoot it down the street and this will be non-period and we'll do something weird and like...
Yeah, well, also, she seems like such a New York personality. Why would she ever be here in the first place?
When she came back for Colin, A Year in the Life, it was like a 5-month vacation. Or right? Like, it was just like, I'm here for a second, whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, she ain't never coming back.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely not for a Gilmore thing, anyway.
It would be great if they had guest directors for the Gilmore episodes. Like they have like a... Like,
Ava DuVernay.
They just get Sorkin in for the first, you know, it's just like, it's always been meaning to
Did
be
Did you
a
see
thing.
Molly's Game?
No, I didn't.
Because he directed it.
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
Oh, really? It was a
I love Aaron Sorkin. There's things in it that are amazing, and then there's a lot of things where it's like, uh-oh.
Mm.
Let's talk about, okay, we get back to Susie. She answers the phone that the way that Alice answers the phone when I call. Fuck off. That feels like our relationship
but
a little bit.
But I have caller ID, so.
That's true. So you know who you're telling to F off.
Fuck off.
Susie's storyline. She gets threatened by the goons. They take her on a little hijinky adventure to the docks. She has dinner with them. They bond about the same hometown that they're from. They don't kill her, but they say, watch your back. We're going to tell them we couldn't find you. But watch your back because he's coming for you. This comedy agent? I guess he's like a mob guy. I guess this is like a new shade to that.
Yeah. Well, I don't know why, but I feel like it's plausible. Like historically speaking, because it was the 50s in New York and people who had money probably hung out with people who ran organized crime because it was just a smaller world in terms of the like king-making population. So I feel like it's possible.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm just thinking about what if my agents now had mob.
Can you imagine?
To like the Armenian mob. Ugh, my tires got slashed again because of WME and their Armenian mob friends. Anyway,
there's certain moments in this show where Amy just drops the veil completely and she's like, well, this is just me.
That hat is fabulous.
She wanted to be a person walking by that had a hat on.
Brosnan makes this really goofy, this like cartoon dog face
for
when she
hat?
Sees it. Yes, when she sees a hat. Okay, so the whole thing with Rose left Shalhoub.
Yeah.
So they go to Paris to go get her, and she's living a different kind of life now.
Mm-hmm.
Run down, beaten down, and she seems to have not a care in the world.
So?
Mama, we're just concerned.
About what? You crazy lady, you!
You just took off with no word.
I told your father I was leaving.
Yes, but he doesn't remember, so it doesn't count.
Well, I'm sorry you were worried. Apology accepted. Get your things. Pack up your one fork and your half a plate, your used cigarette, and let's go! No. You are coming back to New York right now.
Papa, this isn't sweet.
Fuck sweet. She got a dog.
It was a great line. So to me, this felt like a strange... Sorry again for the comparison. It felt like a spiritual successor to The Reigning Lorelei when Richard Gilmore's mother dies. Emily finds a letter saying, I want you to marry Penland Lott. And she just goes ham and starts smoking and lounging around a house in a robe where it's like, this is my most me now. I don't care about putting on airs. I don't care about playing the game. But instead, where that one was played for laughs and kind of a contained one episode thing where it's just like, I'm just kind of doing my Grey Gardens cosplay in the living room.
Mm-hmm.
This is more like, now I'm hurt and I'm going to leave and I'm out of here. And this seemed to give it a little more emotional weight to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed to take Rose's pain a little more seriously, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah.
Leading to the terrific line that we both texted each other about where Midge says,
I've missed you, Mama.
I've missed me too.
Oof. Yeah. That nails it for me.
Yeah.
Because what was this whole first season about was, you know, where does Rose fit in to this new life of Midge's and this new career of Abe's new, you know, he doesn't really have a new thing going on, but Abe's thing is that he has his thing. He has his routine and his thing, and he doesn't like it being messed with at all. And so she kind of fits in and around the corners of that. And so when her daughter goes off and has this new life that doesn't make any sense to Rose, and it's outside of the plan, you know, the show is about that character. Like, it's that one of those things where you're writing a character that's in the midst of falling apart and having their identity fall apart, and it's really hard to care about that as a viewer. You're like, I never gripped onto who that person was in the first place enough to care. I love the actor.
It seems peripheral.
I identify with the ideas she's having, but who is, you know? And now this is a total switcheroo between Abe and Rose for me, where it's like Abe is the one who's trying to fit in around, you know what I mean? Like Abe's like, wait, my whole life's been disrupted. My identity, you know? And Rose is like holding court. And for me, when I see that apartment, the set decoration for me was like really, really everything, because I look at that house and it's not weird at all to imagine a person like Rose living in conditions like that.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's like my, like one thing I'll do is I'll go sleep in my car sometimes.
Is that true?
Yeah.
I used to do that too.
I sleep in my car because I have a hatch. Terrifying. I have a hatchback.
Party of one.
Thinking of that picture we took where you looked evil.
Ah, no, we're not posting
it. In my car.
Good grief.
So I have a hatchback and I'll put one seat down so that you can access the boot of the car, and I'll go and like climb in there and curl up, and like nobody can see me, and I like sleep, and I have these fantasies of like total freedom. You know, like, I don't know anybody. Like, I'm just, you know, this is not like a to say I want to live in my car, but it's just the idea of being mobile and being free and like unencumbered and living a spare monastic life in a way. And like, people see Rose as this like archetypical housewife that I need my plates, I need my pink soap, I need my dinette set, I need my, you know, all her life is constructed of things. And that's what her life revolves around, is shopping trips and things and making more things and buying more things. And that's not who she is. That's not who anybody is. And so, like, I completely identified with her living in this. I just don't feel like we have a lot of evidence of, like, female characters, especially older ones, like, being able to live in this kind of, you know,
again,
what I mean?
Female indulgence. It's just not something weird.
It's female indulgence in something, in a monastic, like, intellectual... Yeah. Like art, she's living as an artist.
Although she does have the plate sent by Zelda.
Yeah, but I think that was just a way to get to the address too. I love that storyline so much. And then when she said, "I miss me too," it's like, yeah, you don't get it. Like, none of you have ever seen me. And that is such a mom thing, right? That's such a thing that I feel like so many mothers who are the heads, de facto heads of households go through, where it's like, I do all this stuff for you all the time. And I'm, you know, you're biting the hand that feeds you, and none of you see me. None of you see who I am. I'm not mom. I'm a person, you know?
Right. And any time for yourself always feels like, whoa, calm down. What are you doing?
Like, and people always look up to dad, like the man. The man that my dad was this. The man that my dad was, he would never, you know, and it's never like that about your mom. So it's so interesting to see her have this moment. It really made me happy.
It was really cool how it did seem to play the reality of the first season too, even the way they like planted the Paris thing pretty early on. So as much as we're saying like, wow, you actually went there, like they did talk about it in the first season. They did talk about like, oh yeah, my heart's kind of there, like kind of like yearning for that or whatever her past was. So that's cool. It felt it's a little more elegant, I think, than like, the culture shock.
I'm coming into it, man.
Also this line.
Marie's not a Nazi. She's just flexible.
Wait, what is that? I didn't get that.
Marie's not a Nazi.
I heard it. I just didn't understand it.
Oh, I think it's just like the idea of a lot of people who are Nazis aren't like, I want to be a Nazi. They're just like, oh, okay, I guess I'll do this. So I think it's speaking to that idea, just the idea of complicity.
I thought it was like physically flexible. And it was like some
Nazi raise her arm up to heil?
I don't know.
That flexible?
Is there some Nazi gymnastics thing I didn't know about?
I hope not. They go to dinner. So the dinner has, this is something we did in the first season of the show. The dinner has the only sighting, I think, of a Palladinoism in the episode, which is when Rose brings Simone in her baggie to the restaurant. And at one point, Abe gets so pissed off, he screams the following, which maybe a certain other matriarch screamed in season one of Gilmore Girls.
Please stop talking to the dog.
Stop talking to the dog!
Isn't that strange?
Really?
From the third Lorelei.
Huh.
So... Again.
See, with the Palladinoisms, I'm always like, your eagle eye is what's going to... But I'm always like, I feel like it could be anything. Like, you could look up any line and...
They said, hey, and then they said, hey. No, I
in
understand
the morning,
this
they
isn't...
drank tea.
And then they drink tea in this
and
show.
And then they drink tea.
It just triggered it for me because it was yelling about the absurdity of talking to dogs.
Yeah.
I feel like that is kind of specific. There was another one
it
here where they like...
It has to be three times to be an ism is my new rule.
Really? Yeah. Oh, well, this is going to be tough. Okay, let's say...
Kevin hasn't shown up for work in weeks.
It has to be three times if it's like...
He's like rocking back and forth.
Super generic.
Three times to be an ism.
Stop talking
three
to
times
the dogs. Stop talking to the dogs. I record myself saying, "Stop talking to the dogs." They have dinner. Abe storms off. Midge and Rose have the following conversation in the beautifully lit streets of Paris, France.
Oh, they do.
Afterwards.
What about Papa?
Your father's always been very good at taking care of himself.
Mama, listen to me. You have to get over this. The world is full of disappointments, and sometimes people let you down. You can't just run away.
What are you getting so upset about?
You made a commitment to this man. He is your husband. You have to go back to him.
Well, look who's talking.
Pop culture reference. I'm just kidding. She loves Travolta. She loves babies.
That got me, I gotta say. So, yeah, that was a great moment. Now that's a fucking strong, like, leader mom, you know? Like, that's like a, that's who I always wanted Rose to be.
Is kind of bulletproof, because there's such a strange...
Is like silly and goofy and like having her coibles, but also foibles, but like
her
also
quirks being and foibles.
Able to, moms should be able to say that cutting thing, I think, you know? In Paladino's world.
Yeah, the Emily-esque obstinance, though, of her, like, I don't need anything. I don't need him to apologize. I don't need him to do this. I don't need to do that. Like, there's something about it that is so frustrating.
Sure.
As a viewer, because you are just put in that Midge position of, like, just talk to me.
To be able to go, but think about this, to go to your husband and say what she said and have him not fucking hear you, that is a marriage in which I'm going to Paris and I'm going to live my life. And I feel like, well, you established this reality.
Mm-hmm.
You made the rules. So this is what it is. Like, to me, that makes total sense as a retaliatory move. And also as, like, I am now existing within your reality and I'm doing the only thing I can do to make myself happy, you know, which is, like, to live my own life. Because you will only live your own life and you won't let me into yours.
Have you watched past this episode?
I've watched a little bit of the second one because I had to. It couldn't.
As of recording this, I haven't seen.
No. I don't want to watch ahead.
I kind of want to keep, parse it out.
We'll see.
Feels nicer to watch it this way.
It does. We'll see.
But do you ever feel like you never get to, like, digest anything anymore? Where it's like, let's just think about this for a second rather than just like, you know.
Yeah, well, I mostly eat Soylent.
All right. here, this is crazy. I actually have...
This is crazy.
This is crazy, but I actually have audio tape of Amy Sherman Palladino seeing a man dressed as a woman for the first time.
Oh, no.
This is Amy in
2018
seeing a man dressed as a woman for the first time.
For men? All of you?
Oh, my God.
Did you know this? Yes, you probably did know this. That's probably why you came here. My God. I've never seen anything like this. I mean, in college, there were plays where some of the boys were dressed up like girls for a joke. You know, honey bun for the talent show. But that was just socks stuffed into their mother's bras. They never looked like that. I don't think men do this in America.
Oh, they do.
You're an American.
Sort of. I'm a New Yorker.
Anyway. Oof. So.
Okay.
I said men dressed as women. They could be trans in this instance. They don't really define it. But so Midge, after having that conversation with Rose, stumbles into, I guess, kind of a drag club.
Yeah.
This speaks to me, the fact that old Amy's even getting in the mix on this. This speaks to the mainstreaming of drag culture as much as anything. The fact that RuPaul is not monocultural, but RuPaul, like, that sort of thing is really omnipresent now to the point of, like, that doesn't seem fringy and odd. I even remember when Magic Mike XXL came out, there's a scene where all the dudes go to a drag club and have a great time, and one of the guys gets up there and does the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And even at the time, it came out in 2015, it felt like, oh, this is a little bold. This is great.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean,
at the time, but now I feel like in 2018, and maybe I'm overstating it, but now it just feels like it doesn't seem strange for anyone to embrace drag culture and give it platform. Granted, this is a period piece. This is set in the 50s, so Midge's reactions do kind of make sense in that. But it does feel like Amy being like, oh, okay.
Huh. For sure. Yeah, it does too. But also, I don't know. Like, I feel like I've seen so many representations of drag, performance drag, like, in movies and TV for so long that I don't think that it's like... But there is a mainstreaming of it. But it never felt like a bold thing. I felt like drag was always accepted as, like, the performance aspect of drag. Like, I feel like there's, like, Disney movies that have people as drag doing drag.
Oh, maybe.
You know? Like, it's not...
In Magic Mike, I think what I found to be kind of bold about it was their participation in it and celebration. Because it was, like, a group of straight guys just, like, going to drag club being like, hell yeah.
That's right.
So that's why I felt like, whoa.
Yeah.
And... the fact that, like, movies as monoculture as it gets, this year, like, A Star is Born, where it's, like, the inciting incident is Jackson sees Allie at a drag club. Mm-hmm. So it's, like, the movie that everyone's mom has seen has that in it. Whereas before, it's, like, you could see, like, queer coded things or like queer text or subtext and like Disney movies and stuff. But now it feels like, okay, we're here. And this is this feels like Amy
trying to
running to this train, kind of taking off from the station, like, oh, I think I get this too, right? And you know,
she's
doing the best.
She's got two tickets and one's not for the right train car. And she's like shuffling the papers. Well, I guess this is not, you know, it's just like, you know, there's nowhere to sit. And she's like, excuse me. Yeah, totally. Yeah. And that's fucking was rough watching the Amy proxy.
It felt like taking your racist uncle out to dinner.
Okay. All right.
At a place where a person of color was your waiter.
And the whole,
like, this is a bomb.
You're so beautiful. You shouldn't have to be like the, like, it felt so gross, that part.
Oh, this part.
You can't have it all.
On ne peut pas tout avoir.
You can't run the world and have all the pretty underwear.
Et diriger le monde et avoir aussi de la belle lingerie.
The competition was too stiff enough.
Déjà passé le concurrence avec les grosses salopes de secrétaire qui rôde.
You're already fighting with some asshole who's trying to get in front of you in line and steal your cab and bendles while you got one arm full of shopping bags and the other holding onto your son so he doesn't run away and drink from the puddles and then out of the blue, a mother comes along and hits you over the head with a piece of pipe he found at a construction site and completely knocks you out.
Nous en sommes complètement.
So great. Because that's how she gets into it, is her, like, shock. And that's how...
It does end in celebration, where it's like, oh, you're beautiful.
But I don't like the celebration, the excessive celebration.
It seems like a condescension.
It feels like, aren't you doing so well? Like...
But that would be how someone in the 50s would acclimate. It's hard to put 2018...
I don't think they would. I think they'd be like, wow, okay. You know, like, I feel like they would just kind of be weirded out and be like... Is this normal? Okay. You know, but like treat them as human. Like I feel like there's a way to treat them as people without like so...
Putting kid gloves on.
Conspicuously being on board for it. You know what I mean? That felt gross to be like, I love it so much. It's just like,
I'm actually one of the good guys. Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
That bothered me.
Yeah. It's tough because we're viewing it through so many lenses.
Well, and also... It's one of those things where, and she does this all the time, where she makes the heroine like she's so great. Everything she does is great.
Uh-huh.
She has the right opinions. She has the right, you know, she's never wrong. You know, like you're supposed to like her all the time. And it's like, I don't know. It just feels Pollyanna. I don't know. It's just I don't care.
This is a game that everyone plays, though, in the conversation of like, even like a lot of male critics are like, oh, this is because this was made pre-Me Too, or a lot of it was conceived you know, before then. And then it coming out, it does seem of a time and like women reclaiming what is identity, what is power and all this stuff. But that being said, I think there is such this, it happens in every show where there's a female protagonist. Every show. Again, it kind of gets back to that conversation of like, do we allow female indulgence? Of like, you're a feminist hero, right, Midge Maisel? Where it's like, not really.
Yeah.
Like neither was Lorelai or Michelle or Olivia Pope or like these women aren't built to carry the weight of all your cultural expectations, but we still kind of zero the conversation into like, well, you're kind of everything we need. You're
exactly
our,
and
you're
that
kind of
to
our
me,
hero.
But this was a move that like supports
did
that,
that,
which bothers
I
me.
I see
why
yeah,
it bothers
yeah, yeah.
me because I'm like, I don't need her to be super okay with this.
The what bothered
she
me
can be confused.
Yeah. I will say, I think what rubbed me
her mind can be blown without her being like cool
right,
about
right.
it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, like a
slower. I'm one of the good ones.
It did feel like that. The French translation stuff. It's a choice.
It's a choice.
That was bold.
It's
and it was
magical
worth it for
realism.
Them. Yeah, it is magical realism. That's when I was like, this is a fairy tale.
This is a fairy tale.
Yeah. And
the
I guess.
The beginning when she's helping everybody, the minute you're in the movie in the beginning, she's helping everyone. No one can do their jobs
right,
at this
right,
place,
right, right.
And she's the only one. Ooh, she's been up at the. She's until the later season, but she's been in the show. You know, like
it's an R-rated Disney movie.
We have. I forgot about Midge and how Midge Maisel is just amazing, and it's a Rory Gilmore. It's like it's amazing. She's a superhero.
Mm-hmm. Well, Rory Gilmore seasons 1 through.
Right, but she's an amazing, like, uncanny. A super complex super being that is just a fun hang at the same time.
Yeah.
And I forgot about that when I started watching this. I had attached to this story without remembering that we're supposed to all be in that world and believe that. And so when they did the phone thing, I was like, oh, yeah, that's right.
Well, and because sometimes we've actually talked about it as like,
would stand-up work like this? Do jokes work like this? And the answer to a lot of those questions is no. And, right. like, no way would some of these jokes, like, work cross-culturally, cross-linguistically, where so much of comedy is based on timing and the choice of words. It's like, no way.
No, that's crazy.
Yeah, it's insane.
It's insane, but the whole, but it's funny.
The rhythm at the end when they kind of got into it, and I did like the actress a lot who played the American who could translate.
Yeah.
Who recommended Celia Plath. I thought she was really good. It was like the best case scenario of that. I think I wanted like two less minutes of it or something, but where it's like, okay, we got it. But I did like it as a window to get back to, you know, where the point where we left off.
Phenomenal.
In the season finale. And how it does end up, like you were saying before, everyone's just so bummed out by the end.
It's funny.
You know what? It's a bilingual Nanette. Because you start laughing, but by the end, it's like, wow, I got to go home and think about my toxic masculinity.
The end of it, and she's like, how? And that's why.
Midge Maisel goes, my people.
People. He was my husband. He cheated on me. And that made me feel bad. So
my life fell apart today, didn't it? No, that's not it. God.
Just imagine. All right. So, and that's why I guess I like the beginning of the episode so much. Because, like, it needs to prep you for that. Like, you need to move right into this reality. Because it is not reality. It's this world.
No.
This is the marvelous reality in which this person is a super,
marvelous
super
reality.
Person. Yes. And they have the ability to turn a room of French. You know, also, the other thing about this is like, hey, did you guys have any other acts going on tonight? Because right now they're just waiting for this other person who is, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it's just, yeah, of course it's ridiculous. But it was all in service of the story and it worked for me. My one thing I'll say is that, like, there's a bump for me. The two ideas bump with Midge being the central character that is the ASP superhero character. I feel like we need to come up with a name for, like, the supergirl or, like, you know, the like, overly...
I have an old saying about that. You know what it is?
What? I need to know it.
Amy Sherman Palladino keeps getting older. Fast-talking brunette stay the same age.
Stay the same age. Right. Okay. So, like, the fast-talking brunette who is able to literally
FTB.
Do anything.
All the FTBs.
All the FTBs. Mm-hmm. You know, like Midge says it herself, I'm amazing. I can do anything.
Yeah, multiple times in the episode.
That is that character. Mm-hmm. And then the world has already acquiesced to that reality and everybody knows it. And she's able to go around just charming people. And that's fine that we tell the story that way. That's fine. But at the same time, you're also watching a person, a human, grapple with learning something new that they have not mastered. So how does that, you know, like sometimes those two things rub up against each other because learning how to do stand-up, it's not something where you're always constantly winning everybody over.
Yeah.
And so they have to – it's a delicate balance that they have to strike. And I think they did a really good job with it on the whole in season one. But, you know, there's parts at which, like, that we're not telling the story of somebody learning about themselves through stand-up when we're telling the Midge story at the same time. Because that person can't have – you know, it doesn't exist.
It's hard when one show feels like two shows. This is such a syndrome on Better Call Saul where there's like all the Jimmy stuff and all the Mike and Gus stuff. Mm-hmm. And even in Gilmore, when like season six, when it was like Rory at college and Lorelai in Stars Hollow. And it feels like these need to have something to do with each other. Mm-hmm. And the show functions at its best, I think, in conversations where like conversations between Joel and Midge affect stand-up stuff, where that's like a direct...
Yep.
So that's why when we get into as fun as like Rose and Abe and dogs and all this stuff, like I do have more of a heart in watching the show and more in an interest in like, let's just see like as magical realism and as historically inaccurate as it may be, let's see her doing the clubs in Philadelphia. Let's see her blah, blah. Mm-hmm. Like I am more interested in that road story with personal stuff as it affects that stuff.
That said, big ups to Brosnahan because
big ups.
The way she handles Midge's like, I will now just go up on stage and start talking. She does this thing where it looks like she's in her head and she's working something out aloud, and it's super uncomfortable to watch. Where it's like, what is this person doing? Getting up on stage, being like, wow, I'm having a thought out loud, and it's like, no, don't do that. Don't have a thought out loud. But Midge is doing it, and it's because she's never stopped talking from the day she was born. So she's doing it, but I feel like Rachel Brosnahan has a way of playing it where it seems like she knows what she's doing already a little bit more. Like, she's a little bit more aware than she's pretending to be already, which yeah. feels like she's developing a stage persona.
She's so good, too. You know, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
You go.
She's so good at externalizing internalization, which is really hard to do.
Yeah.
It's so hard to show a person thinking. Uh-huh. And like making those decisions,
you know, really
in real time?
Good at that is Juliette Lewis. I don't know why I thought of that, but somebody's talking about what he's eating Gilbert Grape, and then I was thinking of what's that movie where they were on the boat and it was scary?
The Other Sister.
No.
Cape Fear.
Cape Fear. The Other Sister. I forgot that she did that.
Woo, yes, she did.
Yeah. God, she's good at that. Anyway.
Okay, well, let's talk, you know, the flashback. Midge goes to see Joel after the set, after that, the events in the season finale. He gives her the ring back and kisses her on the cheek, walks away. Then it cuts to present day after that little flashback, mm-hmm. and they have a conversation on the telephone.
I love you, Joel.
I love you too.
I am in love with you. So deeply in love with you.
You're killing me, Midge.
We can do this. We can figure this out. I can figure this out. I can figure anything out. I am amazing.
I know you are. You don't have to tell me any of this.
So then why? Why? Tell me why.
Because for us to be together, you'd have to give it up.
What? Stand up?
I can't be in a marriage where my wife is going off and talking about me to a room full of strangers.
Talking about my faults, my mistakes, my failures.
You don't understand. The whole point is you go off and talk about your life.
No, I do understand.
Sometimes.
I understand completely. I know you have to talk about your life.
I think Dimitri Martin's doing that.
That's why you're good. Because you're honest. It's real. It's authentic. It's everything I wasn't up there.
I get it. I just can't live with it.
I wish I could. Maybe another man could, but I just can't be a joke.
Enter Lenny Bruce.
You are not a joke.
Do you want to quit?
No.
I don't want you to quit either. You're too good. So, you see where I'm going here? Follow me down the road. If you're not going to stop, I can't be there for it. Now, why are you in France?
Long story.
I'd like to hear it sometime.
I love you.
I love you too, honey.
Oh, no. Are you crying right
I'm
now?
I'm crying again.
And you're going to be okay.
Oh. Okay. So I know there was a lot of conversation in season one of this show about Joel and his value to the show and his role. And it's like, get on with it. Like, mm-hmm. why do we need this? Or why is he a series regular?
Take your shirt off, right?
Yeah, I don't remember saying that one, but it probably was said at some point.
For me, it's like, take your shirt off.
You and Jamie Lee were very horny for Joel. I remember that. But this, I think, is the best scene to date with Joel.
It is.
This is extraordinary. You know what this is, too? This reminds me of scenes where a character that you underestimate or you perceive to have some sort of flaw or deficit that's unbeknownst to them, it's like when they realize it. So it's the scene in Forrest Gump where he sees, Ginny had a kid. Mm-hmm. And he says, is he smart or is he like me? And he kind of gestures to himself and starts getting choked up when mm-hmm. Tom Hanks does that. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know.
Yeah.
You know what you're like. So in this scene, Joel, you know what I mean?
He means super smart.
Yeah, so is he like me? Is he a genius?
Smart, or is he like a genius?
But in this scene, Joel's saying like, "Listen, I think you're great, and I know I'm kind of being a schmuck here, but his awareness of that fragility of his masculinity, or like his insecurity mm-hmm. of identity, of like, I don't want to be a joke, because I think some guys would be like." Yeah, I know stage stuff is like, you have to do your thing. Like,
yeah.
But he can't. And he knows that he can't. And he knows that's at odds with her greatness and her potential and becoming a household name. That's an extraordinary scene. It's very hard to pull off. I think they do it really well. And it's the most likable I think he is in the show.
Oh, for sure.
Is when he shows that frailty. He's very vulnerable and open with that stuff.
He's vulnerable It takes so much strength for someone to be that vulnerable in their, like, what they're weak about, and just admit defeat and admit that this is where they, this is a big, huge blind spot that they don't think they can overcome, and be like, this is where I am. And the one thing I would argue is that he's saying, like, okay, as a partner, my needs are this. I have to be with somebody who isn't going on stage and talking about me and performing in this way. I don't have the capacity to absorb that. At the same time, though, when you were not doing that and you were just being Midge, you were cheating on her. So do you know what I mean? In some ways, you were having your own identity crisis about the fact that, like, your wife was not enough at that point. But now that she's, you know, this
has, interesting,
you know, yeah. So it's like, yeah. Okay, but – so you, what you need then, Joel, is for me to go home and be doing nothing all day so that you can go out and cheat on me. Okay, cool, 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 cool. Be right home, buddy. Right. You know, like,
it becomes a binary choice of, like, you can't be great and married to me. You have to either be great or be married to me and just, like, function.
And then suffer.
Yeah.
Because what I need is for somebody to be great and I can't handle it.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, he's almost there. He's almost understanding.
You're so
that.
Hopeful for Joel. We're,
no,
we're,
but I'm not saying he's necessarily going to get there. But what I felt in this scene was for Midge. Mm-hmm. Because, like, I have been there so many, I'm going to cry, I'm talking
that's
about
okay.
it. I've been there so many times where a guy's like, I can't, you know. And you're just like, but I just want this thing for myself. I just want to be happy. You know, I can't control the fact that, like, I do a thing. This is what I'm going to do. And you said you wanted to be here for it. And they're like, sorry. You know, and you're just like, but we hate it. And then he's like, when he's like, I love you, honey. Like, that really got me, because it's just like that comfort of, like, you know, they still have this thing together. They still have this camaraderie and this friendship and this marriage. And then, but, you know, ugh. And then she fucking walks down that hallway, dude.
That gorgeous. Frickin', I wonder what hallway that is, but man, it's one of my favorite endings ever.
It's such a great hallway, guys. Yeah. Ugh, my God. I cried on the episode. You haven't ever seen me cry, right?
No, I haven't. This is a real special
He's
moment.
He's seeing it.
You are patting yourself on the back for being so open with
me
right
so
now.
I'm so vulnerable.
Oh my gosh.
It's all fake.
What's funny about...
I'm like a Lucas Hedges.
Oh my gosh.
Cry like that.
Is he a good crier?
Mm-hmm.
Is he a John Cryer type? He was good in Boy Erased. I really liked him in that. And
somebody
Lady Bird
tweeted
and stuff.
Out like movies of the year. Ben is back. Boy Erased. Beautiful boy.
Is
Ben
it him?
Is a beautiful boy. Ben is erased. No more erasing. Beautiful. Erased. Boy beautiful.
I wish I liked Boy Erased more, but I didn't. But he's very good in it. But I think that conversation too, the one you're describing that you've been in a lot, the one that Joel and Midge have. You connect with it so much because it's not really analogous to conversations you've had. It is the conversation
you've had. I've had.
I think for a lot of people, maybe men and women, but definitely women, because this feels like the threatening of male identity in this conversation. This is a conversation that usually happens subtextually.
Yeah.
And it happens maybe invisibly, and it becomes resentment. There's almost a, you know what I mean? There's almost a gift in the fact that it's so baldly and blanketly what it is when you talk about it, because I think the way most people experience it is through passive aggression and through the erosion of trust over time. And
all these
like invisible ways where it's like, oh, if I do this and the girl I'm with does this or the woman I'm with does this, well, that doesn't really threaten me, but I do, wait, does she make more money than me? Wait, do her friends like her more than me?
Right.
And we're not going to have a conversation about it because she's not like selling me out on stage or something. But man, maybe I do feel threatened by it. So it's something, I think it's something that gets to a more universal truth.
And so then I'm going to start acting out over time about that and not having an affair, but, you know, like having an emotional affair at work. And then that's going to make me pick on my relationship. Like, yeah, for sure. And then, so instead of like, so it's just the boiling down of that entire disruption into one moment and one conversation, which is why it's so potent.
Beautifully played, and especially too on the phone. On the phone's hard, but they did it.
So hard.
I wonder if they were there for each other. Well, no, Zegan didn't fly to Paris to be there on set, but I wonder if she was there for his, you know, for the reverse. Let's do some Twitter Q&A.
Tweet, tweet.
Here we are.
I can't believe we have Twitter Q&A.
We have Twitter Q&A. I put it out a few hours before we started recording.
Oh, fantastical.
At Avnito, this is a pretty easy one, says, Out of the two of y'all, who'd be able to charm themselves out of a bad sitch a la Susie? It's definitely you.
Oh my God, it's Could you imagine?
I would be dead within 15 minutes of them picking me up and threatening
even
me.
Even if they hadn't planned to kill you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It would just have happened.
They're like, we just need to take you to the post office.
You know what? You're kind of annoying. Do you mind if I kill you? Oh, boy. Okay. At Token Scorpion says, did at one point you think that it was going to come out that Midge and Lenny Bruce effed after the Gaslight gig?
Yes.
Because it felt like they were setting that up for a split second.
Well, they are setting it up for a split second.
Do you think?
Yes. No question. We haven't talked about this, but when they say it in the room, they foreshadow it in the Paris drag show. The guy goes... after the story's over and it's all quiet, there's a guy up in the balcony who goes like, I prefer Lenny Bruce.
No, he says Jerry Lewis.
Jerry Lewis.
Yeah.
Oh.
So maybe they're setting up that she's going to hook up with Jerry Lewis.
I'm an idiot.
No, you're not.
I thought that would be so cool if he was like, I wish she'd go with Lenny. You know, that would be such an ASP. So anyway, I read into that, but I do think they are trying to foreshadow that a little bit. I think they're trying to tease it because they did have chemistry in the beginning, and now she is essentially free, and Lenny is around.
At Miriam Isaro writes in, longtime listener. Thank you, Miriam, for the question. She says, I mean, Daniel definitely wrote the cartoonish thugs who wouldn't hurt a Rockaway girl, right? Those felt like Daniel scenes in the middle of an Amy episode.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Where it's like, I mean, we're all having light, fun.
Light and goofy.
L&G.
The thing with the scene, the little girl. Like, you better find that quarter, so Daniel.
It's also like, we're already here? Again, maybe it's good to think about Amy stuff as like an R-rated Disney movie.
Yeah.
And maybe Midge Maisel will be in the next Disney Princesses movies alongside with him. They deconstruct that pretty well in the new Ralph Breaks the Internet.
They do. Oh, yeah, I heard about that.
They do.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, a friend of the show, former guest, Pamela Ribbon, wrote that movie. She voices Snow White in it because she's so good at it.
Wow.
And she wrote all the stuff with the Disney princesses
cool.
in it, where they like deconstruct like, oh, do you need a man to sit? Like, they hit all the tropes. Yeah. It's really smart. In the middle of a movie that's smart, too, but it seemed like particularly... Mm-hmm. I think they're going to make a franchise out of, like, the princesses teaming up at some point.
Amazing.
Hey, Advi Commons said, did anyone cry during this episode, mailing the Midge Joel phone call? Do you think that Joel is redeemable / was partially redeemed this episode or season overall? I think the redemption for me is on, like, why do we need this character? And less so, like, the man who he is. But well, his value to the story, I'm really curious
how... His value to the story is, well, Midge said it. We have children together. We're going to see each other for the rest of our lives.
Right.
You know, so he might not be the romantic, you know, but he always has that Christopher, you know.
Oh, sure. But Christopher was in, like, 2 episodes a season.
I know, but he's still... being in 2 episodes a season didn't mean that he was, like... the brass ring of, you know.
Right, but I'm saying Joel's in every episode this damn season. I think. I mean, we haven't
seen
it
I'm just
it
saying
yet.
He doesn't have to be walking alongside Midge to be as important to
sure.
her.
I'm just going to, I'll be a little bummed if this season ends up being like, Midge and Susie on the road. What's going on with Joel and Ethan? Wait, okay. Joel and Ethan? Is this a Coen Brothers movie?
It's true. Oh my God, Joel and Ethan. That's crazy.
They didn't do it on purpose.
So, yeah, I guess there's a possibility of that. But it did redeem this scene, made it like, okay, this is, again, like I said last season, this is interesting to me.
It is interesting.
I know this guy. This is a real guy that I've dated. So let's see if this guy can start to figure out his shit and get his life together. To me, it's like, but what if what's going on with Joel is that Joel meets somebody else that, you know, and he's like, yet again, another ball breaker who's got, you know, like, what if he starts dating somebody above him at a company or, yeah, I don't know. Like, is there a possibility of that for Joel? I mean, there's a lot of ways this could go for me that would be interesting.
I just think, man, after all the fatty.
Also, he should make out with a hot guy.
he should make out with a hot guy?
Yeah.
This is just a page from your fanfic, Alice.
Oh, oopsie.
Oopsie. Oh, oopsie. What's this? A little page fell out of my notebook.
Oopsie,
oopsie, poopsie. That, if you were a comic in this, if you were cast on the show as like a recurring, you would be, your catchphrase on stage would be,
oopsie, poopsie.
And you'd kick your heel up.
Disgusting.
And the audience would go, yeah. And they'd love it. They'd friggin' eat it up.
I'm just a little dad.
Oopsie, poopsie. Gross. That's like an LA comic.
What, I'm just a little
it's
dad?
Like a current LA comic saying things like, I'm just a little daddy. Or something like stupid and whatever.
Are you referring to an actual
It's irreverent. LA comedy, when I first got here, I was like, it's just irreverent bullshit. People just being like, what if I said a duty? You know, and everybody's like, well, okay. It's like,
but what is podcasting if not saying multiple duties on someone's commute?
Moving on. Next question. On someone's commute. Yes.
It's dutying on someone's commute. At Ben Makes TV finally says, what would be the flavor of ice cream for this episode be called? What would it be called? And what would it be in it? It would be extra fudge.
Uh-huh.
Because this episode's very extra. It's got a little fudge in it. And it would be topped with some caramelless Mrs. Maisel.
Oh, my God. Gross.
Gross.
Let's say have Jenny.
Let's just fudge and caramel.
Let's have melt. I know Pete Van Leeuwen. I can make him make a flavor.
Can we go to Jenny's after this?
No, I've got to get ready for the show. But
damn it. Alice is opening up for She and Him tonight.
That's
at the
right.
Wiltern.
And I'm
gonna
did
go,
it last night.
I'm going to go watch her from the back and say, and then punch a guy out after the show and say, she's great. She's great. She's great.
And my boyfriend is going to be there. And
yeah. Garrett will be there.
Funny. Garrett will be like.
He'll be like.
You know, I talk about it all the time. Okay. It's fine. And he'll be like, what are you doing?
He'll be like, oh, great job, Alice. Hey, everybody. I'm a secure man. And I'll be like, she's great.
Why is he always
great.
Saying I'm a secure man?
I mean,
it
he is
me.
A secure man. Why does he keep
saying it all the time?
Oh, brother. Oh, boy. Well, a big Mazel Tov. To the
big Mazel Tov.
To season two premiere. This, I will say, all things being equal, it was a little muted. My expectations for this were a little underwhelmed on some level.
Wow.
They were a little bit. I think it has gems of lines and scenes in it.
We didn't
but,
even talk about the character of the best friend coming in or Susie's using the pink soap, that whole scene. Oh, shit.
Next episode, I think. I think there's a reason we didn't talk about it. But a Mazel Tov to 201.
Idiot.
Hey, you want this iPad? You want to do this? You think this is easy? Because it kind of is. Alice, thanks for joining me. Thanks for joining us, listener.
I love you, Kevin.
You know, I don't receive that so sincerely when you laugh when you say I love you.
I know, but I do.
It feels insincere. And I love you, too.
All right.
And listen, we're going to be doing at least 9 more episodes. We're going to have guests on. We're going to have...
More.
What's that?
If not more.
If not more. Maybe we'll just, you know, keep...
Well, we have to do those bonus-y ones, right?
We can do...
Bonus-y?
We didn't do bonus-y ones last season together.
But I feel like we had ideas for one.
Yeah, we did. But yeah, maybe we do like a full Q&A or a call-in or like we
Ooh,
can put
a...
We could do... We could put up a stand-up show at the Dynasty Typewriter and set dress it like it's the Gaslight with an old-timey mic and then do our podcast.
That sounds good.
That'd be fun. So, Alice, I love you. Thank you for doing the show with me. I look forward to hanging out with you for at least 9 more episodes. Let's go out on a song from the episode. Ooh, Autumn in New York or Tea for Two? Which one do you want to do?
Autumn.
Okay, let's do Autumn.
Autumn in New York.
Is this your Billy?
Does it seem so inviting?
So inviting.
I'm just doing here now.
Autumn in New York.
I will see you next time on The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
We'll see you next time on The Amazing.
Goodbye.
Podcast.
She's great. She's great. Hey. She's great.
World's drunkest agent.
And canyons of steel.
That was a HeadGum podcast.